game, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Decade Project. This is the One Hit Minute Productions Patreon exclusive podcast. I'm your host, Blake Howard. We look back 10 years in our review to see the films that are still hanging around, the still films that are still having a huge influence, or those that are ripe for rediscovery. There's a few films on the list of 2015, as we are in 2025, that were like the undeniables and immediately had, you know, cherry picking lots of people who I wanted to talk to during this series. And the film that I wanted to talk to, one of those that I wanted to talk to the most, was The Grand Budapest Hotel, Wes Anderson's amazing film starring Ralph Fiennes and Matthew Omerick and F. Murray Abraham and Adrian Brody and Bill Murray and Jude Law and Edward Norton and Saoirse Ronan and Jason Sawyer. It just, the list goes on. But there was only one person that worked at a Mendel's bakery, a great artist. And I look at her just like Zero does. It's the fantastic and sensational Brianna Ashby.
Hello.
Hello. So nice to see you. Before we get started, let the folks enjoy a trailer of this delightful movie, and then we're going to come back and talk about all the things and our experience with this movie.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And so my life began. Junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustave H. Many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
I approve of this union.
I became his pupil, and he was to be my counselor and guardian.
The police are here.
Tell them I'll be right down.
She's been murdered, and you think I did it.
Hey! Stop!
You're looking so well, darling, you really are. I don't know what sort of cream they've put on you down at the morgue, but I want some.
This is Madame D's last will and testament to Monsieur Gustave H. I bequeath a painting known as Boy with Apple.
Wow. What? Who's Gustave H?
I'm afraid that's me, darling.
If I learn you ever once laid a finger on my mother's body, living or dead,
I go to bed with all my friends.
We need to make a plan for your survival. Hide this. It's in code, and you might need a magnifying glass to read it, but it tells you exactly where and how to find Boy with Apple.
I'm a baker. I'm not a fence, if that's the term.
May I offer any of you inmates a plate of mush?
I want roadblocks at every junction for 50 kilometers. I want rail blocks at every train station for 100 kilometers.
Get in!
I want 50 men and 10 bloodhounds ready in 5 minutes.
You can't arrest him simply because he's a bloody immigrant.
Take your hands off my lobby boy!
Have you ever been questioned by the authorities?
Yes, on one occasion.
What?
I was arrested and tortured by the rebel militia after the desert uprising.
Right. Well, you know the drill then. Zip it.
I remember seeing this in the theater 10 years ago, saw it, was in a kind of what you usually sometimes can be a really wanky media screening where lots of people are stuffy and cynical and whatever. And it was just a kind of good year because there was like people, I think, that are our age that were all like growing into the now crop of like dominant film critics. And I remember seeing it with a bunch of Sydney film critics who were all just absolutely smitten with it. And we all walked out just gleefully, like, that's maybe Wes's best. I mean, there's so many of his that we love, but we were just so, like, blown away with the movie, blown away with its ambition, how it looked, how it felt. I've since watched it a million times. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I do. It was, I think, if memory serves, the first movie I went to see in the theater after my daughter was born.
Oh, my gosh.
Which at that point she was almost 5 years old, which really says something very sad about A, my time management skills, and B, my dedication to movie going. But I, you know, was an old school Wes head, you know, from the jump. I got introduced to his movies in college, and I had I was like, I am getting out of the house. I am seeing this movie. This is absolutely non-negotiable. And the funniest, I mean, people say that it's not actually haha funny, but like last night when I watched it, I think for the first time since I had seen it in the theater, my daughter watched it with me.
Oh, that's great.
So that we had great. This really cool kind of full circle moment, and she really liked it, which I felt really good and kind of smug about. Like, haha, your mom's cool. Sorry. You're going to have to accept this.
Yeah. I had a similar moment with Top Gun Maverick where I felt like I'd really done something right because my son was with me watching it recently. We're on a family holiday and I was just sitting down watching something. It was after the sensational Val Kilmer pass, and I was like, I can't watch Heat. It would just break me up.
Yeah, so that was like, too much for you.
Too much. So I was like, I'll watch Top Gun Maverick. Obviously forgetting how insane that prospect is, watching Val Kilmer in like his last screen performance in that role with everything that happened.
Didn't quite think that one through
Didn't go all the way there. I should, but it was like, what do I watch that is like semi-family appropriate? Because it was that or Kiss Kiss Bang Bang or Tombstone. It was like, it's not appropriate for a six-year-old. But Top Gun Maverick, I think a six-year-old can kind of handle many ways. And he was like, this is a really, he sat with me the whole time. He's like, this is a really good movie. I'm like, bet your ass it is, kid. That's right. I've done something right. I've done something so right. That's so
if that
good.
Is the only thing that you do right in this entire
that's the metric of success, is that, you know, he's still will, you know, he'll still watch terrible things that I don't understand. But he watched Top Gun Maverick, and that I was like, you know what? That's good.
You planted a very important seed.
Yeah, a Tom Cruise seed with many, many films for him to enjoy. I can't wait till we watch Magnolia together. That one's going to be fun. I'm so glad she liked it. That would have been a treat. How did you even concentrate whilst you were sitting there watching it with her? Were you watching her watch it?
No, I was taking notes.
Oh, you're taking notes. Look at you. Dutiful.
Yeah, I guess. I occasionally need help putting full sentences together, and it really helps me sort of figure out how to do that beforehand. I think she was kind of watching me take notes at one point because she was like, oh, you make arrows on your notes just like I do. Yeah, we are apparently the same exact kind of nerd. It's also unsurprising.
Oh, that's great.
So I mean, it's so engrossing. It just, you know, it sucks you right in.
Yeah, it has a stranglehold on you so quick. And by the time you see Monsieur Gustave, it's like, oh, I'm in. Like this, it's got all this thing that just sort of slowly, the little choral singing that kicks off, and then it gets you. Do you remember when you watched it at the theater, when you walked out, like obviously your first movie in many years, I think you're being mean to yourself to saying that it's like, you're not a good film person because you clearly are, but like you see this, what do you remember the feeling of coming out of it? You're like, oh my God, was it like a satisfaction? Was it a relief? Was it like, oh, that is so great. That's exactly what I needed. Do you remember what it felt like walking out of the theater?
I think there was a real buoyancy
yeah
that I felt coming out of the movie. And then because the thing of it, I mean, really the thing of it is like, there, it is full of, at its core, like so much love and joy and beauty. And you really need to take, like, the weight of it takes a little while to settle in,
yeah.
Which I think is part of the power of Wes's movies overall. You know, there are things you see and, you know, like, and there are immediate reactions to emotional situations that you have in his movies, but like the full gravity of what he's telling you about the human experience, like, it just starts, you know, he plants the seed and then it starts germinating. And then, you know, later on in the middle of the night, you wake up and you're like, oh, holy fuck, you know, like, what happened? Like, what? And, you know, and like the sort of, you know, like, am I lonely? What is loneliness? What does it mean to be a person? And it's all wrapped in this, you know, like the most beautiful thing. So you just, it's sort of like a delayed reaction.
Yeah.
A slow release.
Yes. Yeah. There's only one. I think Wes also sometimes, he does that so beautifully because there's like sometimes where I just like remember, I'll remember Gene Hackman's Royal Tenenbaum taking his grandsons to, I can't remember if it's cockfighting or dogfighting. I always get them confused. Like, he's taking them to like gamble on something, yeah, that's really bad. And I think of his gleeful smile with those kids and I just go, that just like wakes me up at night. And I'll think about it because I'm like, wow, like my grandfathers both passed away when I was a babe. And so I think about that. I'm like, that's just, I don't know. He gets you on that. Whereas on the flip side, kind of one of the Wes's that people took longer to come around on, the Darjeeling Limited. The first time I saw that movie, it like, I was in the right headspace or perhaps wrong headspace. You be the judge, listeners, of what you, I saw that movie and I was destroyed. I was like, that is chaos and joy and really deeply flawed people. And I was like, oh, this is exactly like, I'm exactly on Wes's wavelength right now. And of course I love all of his other movies, Bottle Rocket, you know, all his recent stuff too. And recently was lucky enough to catch the Phoenician Scheme. And yeah, so I'm in for Wes. So I think at the time, huge movie. Probably could have got more Oscar nominations at the time. Really tough year, as we've probably discussed on a couple of the episodes. But like, the extremely boring thing, I'm so glad I'm talking to you about this, the extremely boring thing that's happened in the last 10 years is that people are like, they're completely evade any substantive readings of his movies and they just think that they're these curios. And I'm just like,
every single time I see, you know, a hot take, or I mean, it really at this point, it's a very tepid take to that effect. It still infuriates me. Like, my response to it is never tepid. I just can't fathom that I have seen the same movies as the people making these arguments.
Yes. Yeah. It just seems like this whole, everyone just reductively is like, Wes Anderson diorama. And it's like, sure, he does. He's exceptionally controlled, even more so like psychotically so that you might even think then like a David Fincher, who is so fastidious in particular, works in often big studio settings, has things happening, is so precise with everything that's in the frame. I'm like, Wes is just so obsessed that he's creating a world for you to go to. And I just can't fathom myself, like, you know, preliminary response critically, everything great. 10 years later, some people seem to be tiring, but I'm like, it's not like a meal we have to eat every day. You know, it's not like,
right,
it's not like you're eating the best meal ever and then a week later there's another best meal ever and you have to contend with it. I'm like, no, like once every 18 months to 2 years, you have this phenomenal degustation, peculiar, beautiful degustation menu that you go and feast on. and you have it with friends and you share it. And it's just a great, like, it just satisfies. And then he goes off and makes another one. And you, I can't wrap my head around this thing where people are just so dismissive of style, because there's this great French author, filmmaker. His name's Jean-Baptiste Leray. And he goes, Blake, I'm really glad you got my book in English. We're talking about his book about Michael Mann, a contemporary retrospective. He goes, I'm glad you got it. He goes, but I wish you could read French, because there's something that's lost in translation. He goes, I just want to tell you something. Same in writing as in cinema and in painting or being an artist. He's like, style is substance. Style is everything. Yeah. Forget the words, forget the story. The style is the voice of the person who's creating it. And I'm like, if you can't appreciate the style and then cut through that to go, this is how he's translating these huge, deep, existential, you know, musings on love, life, family, longing. If you can't break through the style to get to the substance, you're not even, you must be too screening or something. You're not watching the movie. You're not consuming it. You're not giving it a shot. So I think that in the last 10 years has been the most infuriating for me. I think some people like, there's certain people who like the ones that they like, but I just, the overarching argument with Wes right now, I'm just like, people are so tired of him. I'm like, do you not watch movies and enjoy them? What's wrong with you?
I'm sorry. He's too good. Things are too beautiful and interesting. And I was thinking about that a lot when I was watching Grand Budapest. And really, it actually struck me that you can really draw kind of a direct line between Grand Budapest and Asteroid City.
Yeah, absolutely.
In particular. I think, so many of the ideas that he really explored in full in Asteroid City started with the structure of Grand Budapest. But I also was really thinking about it in terms of, the formal elements of the style and in whatever, but like also the, how it translated into M. Gustav as a character, and that sort of like, his totally over the top sort of foppish presentation, he was a dandy and it was, the movie's really delicate and in certain ways it's like utterly brutal, but all of the trappings of what that movie looks like and what the characters look like and what they seem like, it's a protective shell. And I think that's true I think that's a through line with all of his work. There's, the people build walls and, put up all kinds of bullshit self-defense mechanisms to protect them against the world. But really, like, people do it a lot to protect themselves against their own emotions or the emotions of other people. And then, so when you start seeing the cracks in, these like beautifully, perfectly, anally constructed little worlds, that's where the power is, once those ramparts start falling and the walls start coming down, or even if it's just like a little crack and you can just see through it, the tiniest bit, it's like, how are you not noticing that that is what is happening? That, yes, like all of this has a purpose. It's not just like, oh, I really like the color pink, let's make it pink. Why do you think it's all pink? Why do you, like, everything is a choice and everything has a meaning. And I just, people's lack of critical thinking skills it's a lot to contend with, because it just seems to be like slipping.
It's not getting, I was just gonna say, it's not getting any better.
No,
it's not getting any better. It
seems to be getting worse.
Yeah.
Constantly
it's,
worse.
It's getting a lot worse. It's, and people with less patience for it, I don't know what it is, but I love what you said there, which is he has such an understanding of And we all have to do it in different segments of our lives. That's why I really struggle to understand with it, because it is such a deeply relatable thing. Because like, and I think that maybe that could be some of the generational gap, because you hear about like whatever they call the young children of today, like Zoomers or whatever, how they, I don't even know what the fuck they call them, their kids, right? Whatever they call that next generation that are not us, kids. But I think that people are like more, in good and bad ways, like nakedly themselves. And so if they go to a job, they don't ever like try and act professional. They just act how they are. And it's like, for people who are our age, it's like, no, when you have a job or you're in a particular social setting or you're with a partner or not with a partner and you're at a something, it's like you wear the face of the party, like whatever that, you know, whatever you're going to, you're kind of putting on a show. And what's so great is that so many of his characters are put on a show, and the bigger the show is, the bigger the cracks are. And it's just wonderful. Like, it's like, oh, if this is the show, I can't wait to see behind the curtain. That's what you just can't wait for. You're like just rubbing your hands together. Like people like you and I, you watch it and you're like, oh, I can't wait to see how this all falls apart, because that's what it is. That's where the humanity is. And he's just, I think he has such a command of it. It's crazy. He's really special. And yeah, that this movie particularly is just littered with people who put on these like very, you know, very structured facades in every way. And especially because they're a concierge, like they're just ultimately people who are there to serve other people. So their facade is all to prop up and bolster everyone around them. And then it's so funny just to see that, like, you know, he sits in his tiny little room in his tiny little white undergarments, eating disgusting looking gruel by himself at night, penning poetry. It's like just the best thing in the world. It's just, I just love it. I love every part of this movie. It's just such a special, special thing.
Yeah. It was really, I mean, I just kept writing and writing and writing while I was watching, because I just kept noticing new things, you know. And it's not like I haven't spent any time thinking about it in the intervening years since I watched it, you know. I just, there's a lot, and there's a lot to parse, and there's a lot to sort of read into. And I think in some ways I was reading through Matt Zellerseitz's Grand Budapest Hotel book. And I was reading the three-part interview that he did with Wes that's interspersed throughout the book. And there are a couple of points where Wes sort of bristles at like an over read of certain things. But I think in a way he also obviously enjoys it. You know, like there are layers there, and, you know, like not everything is controlled. And I think that there is a way that he taps into the, you know, the sort of subconscious stuff. And that's really interesting to me. Like you, like mentioning the Society of Crossed Keys,
yeah,
which, you know, the way they show up on screen, and it's, you know, it's like this murderer's row of actors that have been in his other movies. And it's all very like, I don't know, it's not zany, but it, you know, like it's funny and it's amusing. But I was really thinking about the job that they had really, and what it really meant. And Gustav starts talking to Zero about it when they're sitting on top of a literal haystack in the middle of the field waiting to be rescued by this group of men. And, you know, he's talking to him and telling him all of the things that like a good concierge can do for you. You know, you can get box seats at the opera. You can get a corner table at Chez Dominique on a Thursday. And what they're really doing is, and I think this is an important theme, I think, that runs throughout the whole movie. And then really what made me connect it really significantly to Asteroid City is that the people he's talking about are providing, they're literally opening, literally and figuratively, holding the keys and opening doors to like the most, basically like the most important, poignant human experiences.
Yeah.
To art, to culture, to each other, to like, you know, the opulent boudoirs where people are doing the most like intimate things that people can do. And I just, so they, the power that they actually wield is incredible and important. And also, like, if you, you know, Adrian Brody walks in and he's absolutely threatened by it because he knows the score, and that kind of person knows the score, and that's why they try to stomp out art, culture, literature, everything. Like, we are, this movie could not possibly be more resonant in this moment, which is so unfortunate, but it just really rings so true to what's happening. I mean, particularly in the United States, but
oh yeah,
place.
Yeah, it's we're living in a crazy moment. We're living on the brink of significant hot wars between multiple Mideastern countries. The craziness that's happening in your country, where there's like military parades at the same time as mass deportation, or at least deportation attempts. People are protesting in the streets. Some of the biggest protests ever in the country. It's a wild time. And this burgeoning fascism, it doesn't like intellect, and it doesn't like art, this fascism. It doesn't like beauty. And I think that, I don't think Wes could have had any idea when he was making this that he was anticipating this. Maybe he was feeling the bubblings, the simmerings of culture shifting and changing, and trying to examine and interrogate the conditions that changes. But all he showed was just how beautiful and wonderful a pre-fascistic society was, and how delightful it is in every facet. Even the relationships of prisoners in a pre-fascist world is beautiful. You know, Harvey Keitel with the best, ugliest bald wig of all time, and M. Gustav's dear friend Pinky. You know, that's just, it's just beautiful. You know, it's the whole inspiration for Paddington 2. Also great. Great movie. Yes. But yeah, it's, I don't know how he managed it, but yeah, it is. I don't have any answers for what it is. We kind of got so lucky at the time that we were growing up to not, the world was not in the shape that it is now. You know, there was still nasty shit going down, but it felt like we're having our own existential crisis because we'd achieved some kind of semblance of peace where there wasn't a perpetual war machine, you know, simmering all over the world. I don't know. It's a really interesting one, a really interesting time that we live in, a dark time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, growing up in the 90s, culturally, like, things were, I mean,
music,
allowed to be weird.
Oh yeah.
Like, so much of pop culture was like proudly, wonderfully bizarre. Yeah. Across the board. And there was so much room for that kind of experimentation. And I think, you know, one of the things that Wes was probably reacting to when he made this movie in particular is that, I mean, with the whole, I won't name check any comic book conglomerates in particular, but with the real like dominance of a very specific kind of movie,
mm-hmm.
Starting around that time, like the, you can, if you pay attention to anything, like, which he clearly pays attention to everything,
yeah,
the sort of like dumbing down and homogenization of pop culture was pretty obvious thing. And, you know, it all comes down to money, which is what happens in this movie. You know, it really struck me. I mean, there are some very obvious ways where that is clearly what he's saying, like money bad, capitalism bad, greed bad, wealth bad, you know. But one of the
things wealth for beauty, wealth for beauty, people using their wealth for beauty and for art and for experiences and for love. He's like, there is a line. There's this weird thing that happens where we want people to have these experiences, but it's also, it breeds this discontent. It can breed this discontent when people start feeling like they're entitled for it.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, there's a difference between, you know, the Rockefellers of the, you know, of the world who, you know, founding whatever, you know, libraries or museums or whatever, and like, you know, funneling their like ill-gotten gains in like, you know, sort of like, you know, funneling it back into the world in a way that did, you know, did like something approach balance, you know, like,
yes.
But there was one thing in particular that really stood out to me in a more, it was very subtle, and maybe I am doing the overreading of the scene, but I don't know.
Wes doesn't own it. I just want to say this, and it's the same that happens with my favorite filmmaker, Michael Mann. It's like, once he makes it, the intent is great. Like learning about the intent of what the filmmaker wanted to do, or wanted you to feel, or the level of research that they put into a particular scene is great. It's definitely a lens. But like, once filmmakers make what they make, it's ours. It's not theirs anymore. And like, we can be the first ones to say, like, and especially me, because I'm a Michael Mann head, is like, the very concept that Michael Mann would ever touch one of his movies and edit it again and not make what he originally released available to me to watch makes me mad. I'm like, no, I like the first one.
Just leave it alone.
Just don't touch it, you know? And, you know, one of my favorite memories ever is like meeting Michael. I was like, he's like, oh yeah, the version of the movie that we just watched, that's not my favorite version. I'm like, well, I'm sorry, you're wrong. And I think this audience thinks you're wrong. You know, it was just the only reaction that was appropriate. It's like, well, you know, we're going to have to agree to disagree because that's better.
Sorry, than, I have to beg to differ.
Beg to differ. And all the only expert I am is the audience, right? So I think that that's, but yeah, so no, go ahead, overread. You don't have to apologize for overreading. You're talking to me.
I should know my audience.
You know your audience, which is me. I'm like, no, overread. That's what I want.
Like, do it. Let's get into it. That's the scene where Kovacs is being chased by Jopling.
Mm.
And he takes refuge in an art museum.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't lost on me.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been, he could have ducked into anything.
Yeah.
He could have, you know, it could have even been a different kind of museum. But he was trying to take refuge in an art museum and then was ultimately murdered by this like cipher of like essentially capitalistic greed in an art museum.
Yeah. And what's even worse, it was a deserted art museum. He thought he'd find refuge in seeing people there, but because it's 10 minutes before it's closing, he has no refuge. There's no witnesses. There's no public. He's like, so the only witness is all of that beautiful art and inspiration that's hanging on the walls to watch him get his finger. That's such a great, that there's some gruesome stuff in this movie, but that particular, like poor Jeff Goldblum's delicate long fingers being like
in
the door is nasty. Again, it's a really nasty moment in this movie. And there's some fun, there's other deaths in here that are pretty grim, but that was nasty.
It was. And it was, I think, appropriately. Mm. So, you know, like there is a very specific kind of, you know, not literal violence, but violence to, you know, the attempts of the powers that be to sway culture and make things only in service of a very select few people. Mm. And it's really at the expense of everyone else. And, you know, like Kovacs, his whole thing was, you know, like he was like, I'm an attorney. I follow the law, you know, people trying to do what they are supposed to do. And that one really, that choice really stuck with me.
And I don't think it's an overread, because the beautiful gesture of this whole movie is that, like, Boy with Apple, for the family, it's just currency. It's mm-hmm. just, it's a piece of canvas that is like a cash bond almost. Like, it's like, I'm going to give this to someone else because I don't want it. There's no interest to me. And I'm going to sell it. And what's so wonderful about the conclusion of this movie is that Boy with Apple just hangs. It just hangs
behind the
concierge desk. It's just there for everyone to see. It's like he never sold it. He made his fortune in other ways. That just sits there because he's like, he couldn't bear to not see the beautiful boy with Apple all the time. You know, he couldn't bear that it would be just sold, that it would be some piece of currency. He held it so precious to him. To the end.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also on the back of all the menus in the restaurant.
It is. It is on the back of all the menus.
So people, you know, are being exposed to it, whether they want, you know, whether they notice it or not, you know, they're like, they're getting, I don't know, they're getting Boy with Apple by osmosis, you know, and they're ordering their duck.
Oh, it's so good. It's also there's one little touch that I heard about recently, which I want to mention because it's such a beautiful touch. It's something that I find, because I see so many Australian performers go and, you know, perform, you know, do movies in England and so affect themselves with an English accent, or perform movies in America and have this like generic American accent. But Saoirse Ronan had never done her own accent in a movie until The Grand Budapest, because Wes wanted her to be this character, Agatha. And he's like, and she's like, oh, so what accent should I use? And Wes was like, yours. And she was like, it really liberated me, because then many more movies I was like kind of given permission to do my Irish, you know, beautiful, thick Irish accent in movies. And in here, in the beautiful nonsensical way that Wes Anderson movies just has, like Harvey Keitel speaking like he's from a gutter in Brooklyn in like mm-hmm. what's meant to be an Eastern European prison or whatever. It's just like everyone just speaks in whatever accent is appropriate, and it just works. It just works because he's established a setting where this is how it's going to work. She is so beautiful, and there's a moment in the movie where there's this kind of kaleidoscope behind her as they're at an amusement park, and it's Zero's perspective of her. And I just think it's one of the most magical images that Wes has ever done. It just gets me every single time I look at it. I'm like, oh, that's how you look at someone when you're just smitten. It's just beautiful. And she's amazing in the movie. And there's so many people who are amazing, but their relationship is so adorable. And Tony Revolori is just magnificent. He's also great. He pops up in Asteroid City too. It's so nice to see him. I like when you see someone who's been so dominant in one of the movies just like come in for like 2 seconds, like an Owen Wilson or Bill Murray. It's like you see them for like 2 seconds. It's
just
like
a check in.
Just a check in. Yeah. It's like, do you want to come play for like a couple of weeks? Yeah, sure. I'll come. Okay. You know, it's probably 2 days' work and yeah, I'm finished. Yeah. Great. Great.
Yeah. He's totally fantastic. And the, you know, I love his Wes's habit of pairing unknown actors with like the establishment, you know, and really they in basically every instance just shine. And it's really, really incredible to see him, you know, hold his own against with Ralph Fiennes, you know, they are a duo. They are
The whole movie. They're Batman and Robin. They're just unbelievable together. And that's the only measure of how good an actor is to me, is when they're with another great actor, how well do they do? And he's got to just play the straight man to the absolute most bombastically large, you know, dandy you've ever seen in your life. Rafe is just having too much fun. He should be arrested for how much fun he has in this movie. He's having so much fun and he's making us have such a great time. And yeah, Zero is just beautiful. Beautiful. And then even more heartbreaking that it's Murray Abraham is the older Zero, because he just kind of torpedoes you with all this additional, you know, emotional heartache and mileage and seeing the world and in all of its good and bad. He's just magnificent. And Wes loves to play with that. Like, he'll just cast a different actor. It doesn't matter if they look the same. He just kind of goes, I would just want the vibe, and he doesn't care. And in his movies seem to just get that. You know, he doesn't spend $200 million to de-age someone. He just casts a young person, and then, you know, he does it even in The French Dispatch, which I think is so adorable. Like, he's like wild as Tony Revolori early, and then it's Benicio. And like, they just change, you know, they literally stand in front of the camera, change some equipment, give each other a hug, and then that's how it is. He passes it on. I'm the guy. It's really great. And in this movie, I think it works so great. And even it's so great to the dearly departed Tom Wilkinson and Jude Law. Like, there's just, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. I mean, Jude Law looks the same, like, in the last 30 years. His look hasn't changed. He's basically just slightly different hair. Maybe the Widow's Peak is slightly higher, but it's like the Jack Nicholson Widow's Peak.
He's been like set in amber.
Yes. It's ridiculous. But he and Tom Wilkinson, same thing. Fine. Yeah, who cares? I don't need him to look the same. I don't need some stupid piece of makeup. They're just the guy. That's who they are.
Yeah. It's the author and the author.
The author and the author.
Just the author.
Guys, I hate to tell you this. The author. Usually in the Decade Project, talk a little bit about Sliding Doors. And I think it's so nice from this moment that, like, Ralph Fiennes, who'd been kind of stuck in the Harry Potter universe, and there was all those things, he was kind of like in things, and people had recognized that he was like a dark kind of actor, you know, playing things like Amon Goeth in Schindler's List and things like that, which he was Academy nominated for, and English Patient. But I think that people truly slept on what like a magnificent actor he was until this movie. And it feels like since this movie, he's gone off to do a whole bunch of other new and interesting parts. But I really loved that at this moment, Wes like literally chucked this movie at him and is like, if you don't work, this whole thing just breaks. It's like, I've given you. And he held, not only did he carry it, he just was like the, you know, the ringleader of this whole circus. And he does such a magnificent job. And yeah, I think that's, if there's one thing that's endured and one thing that was kind of special, like, everyone else in this movie has gone on and been in other Wes stuff, has gone on and done their little career things. Like, Willem Dafoe is Robert Eggers' new muse, and, you know, there's all these sorts of things. Harvey Keitel pops up in stuff. Bill Murray's bouncing around doing a few more movies. Jeff Goldblum's in The Wickeds. You know, there's people that are doing things. Saoirse Ronan's still in a lot of independent, fantastic stuff. But I feel like him at this moment was like the biggest, I don't know, everyone slept on Rafe until this movie again. And then everyone's like, oh no, he's like the best. And like all the way up to kind of Conclave in the last, you know, 6 to 12 months, where people, you know, were like, wow, that's a really great movie and he's fantastic. And I think for some of us for the last decade, we're like, no shit, he did Monsieur Gustave. So that's it. That's like, if he could do that role, he can, and it was Voldemort and Gustav, he can do anything. Like, he can literally, he's been in everything, all the full spectrum.
I mean, the range that he gets to explore is, it just runs the gamut from Z to A, they would say. But he really gets the opportunity to, I mean, because he's, you know, there aren't a lot of actors that sort of transcend time and place at this point. And, you know, you could put him in a movie from the 40s and he would fit in seamlessly. And, but, you know, he got to be funny.
Yeah.
So funny.
So funny.
And physical and also, like, you know, it takes a lot to be that emotionally controlled, where, you know, like his, wherever he came from, whatever his life was like before, that's informing what he's like now. And, you know, his need to be doused in l'eau de panache all the time, you know, is this protective barrier. I mean, I find that running gag to be both really funny and really poignant. Yeah, he just he no I mean I don't know. People love to like fantasy cast things. I'm not good at that, nor is that a game that I like am particularly interested in
No,
indulging,
there's
but
only one fantasy casting that I know that you are interested in, which is that Daniel Day-Lewis decided to do Last of the Mohicans instead of being in Dracula. That's the only thing that I know is actually interesting to you, where you're like,
Okay,
"Oh
so
shit."
to be fair then, my only fantasy casting is to put Daniel
There
Day-Lewis in a
you
Wes Anderson movie. That
go.
is the only thing that is missing, and it would make my life complete.
Yeah,
So if
yeah.
either party is listening to this podcast right now, if you could have your people get in touch, that would really mean a lot
I
to
mean,
me
Wes, get your
personally.
people to talk to his people. I mean, what a magnificent thing. There's so many great Gustav quotes. One of my favorites though is when he's looking at Celine's corpse, he goes, "You're looking so well, darling. You really are. They've done a marvelous job. I don't know what sort of cream they've put on you down at the morgue, but I want some." It's so good. It's just so good. It's like everything could go wrong with that line. Everything could go wrong with it because it's in a really serious, like it's the movie takes a quick, serious, violent consequences turn. But just there's just so many magnificent lines on this. It's wonderful. It's just so good.
I mean, that one in particular, you know, and he's like, oh, you did change it. Like, and then like drops her dead weight hand after examining her nail polish. I mean, it is really ridiculous in a lot of ways, but he delivers those lines with like genuine affection for this woman. And regardless of the content of what he's saying, which is like, not even just borderline inappropriate, but you know, when he
No.
stops in the
There's
middle of
no line.
the street
He's
and asks
well.
the maid for a glass of water. Yeah, so funny. But
So
yeah,
funny.
there are a few lines in particular that I wrote down in my notes somewhere. So I'm like, where are they? I'm trying to find them. I should be wearing my glasses because I'm elderly.
I'm in such denial about wearing glasses right now that I'm holding things further away. My font will never go bigger on my phone. I'm not doing that. And some of my friends who are also in denial are like, "What you can do is you take a photo on your phone and you just zoom in."
The
Like
Zoom,
when
yeah.
I'm like,
I do that to people's Instagram stories when I can't read them.
What is this person saying? Oh, okay, got
Yeah, exactly. I can't see it. Like, is this? I need to zoom in on this. I don't know. I can't
don't read.
find
I've
everywhere she
got
wrote
one
about.
quote because we're wrapping up, but I would just say the quote of the movie is how I want to finish. The quote of the movie that I still think about, and it's just exactly that thing that. It's actually two quotes because it's that kind of like, as you said so beautifully, it germinates within you. And the first one is, he goes, "You see, there are still faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity. Indeed, that's what we provide in our own modest, humble, insignificant." Oh, fuck it. And he ends the line because he just can't be bothered. But then
And then he takes a swig of
he
champagne.
takes a swig of champagne. And then Zero later, played by F. Murray Abraham, says, "There are still faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity." He was one of them.
He was one of them. Yeah.
What more is there to say? So thank you for doing this, because what more is there to say?
Thank you for having me.
You are
it's
one
been
of those,
too long.
You are one of those faint glimmers of civilization and art and beauty in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity. And it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Likewise.
What more is there to say?
Carvana's so easy, just a click, and we've got ourselves a car. See?
So many cars. That's a clicktastic inventory.
And check out the financing options. Payments to fit our budget. I mean, that's
Clickonomics 101.
Delivery to our door?
Just a hop, skip, and a click away.
And bought.
No better feeling than when everything just clicks. Buy your car today on Carvana. Delivery fees may apply.